This is the Media Watch Show. We have Miriam Miejean, who writes extensively on issues of gender and violence. A revised edition of her book, Boys Will Be Boys, Breaking the Link Between Masculinity and Violence, was published November 2002. She's lectured widely on these, talking about the socialization of boys to decrease violence. Dr. Miejean has appeared on over 300 TV and radio programs, and today we will be speaking to her about real men, wimps, and our national security, then also the danger of mixing oil and testosterone. I'd like to begin by asking you about your book, Boys Will Be Boys. You ran into a lot of resistance when you wrote this book, and some of your reviews were censored even by liberal left-wing presses. It seems our humanity is unable to acknowledge that violence is predominantly a male habit. Could you speak briefly about the resistance to your work?
Yes, I was really at first stunned by the level of resistance, as I describe in the 2002 introduction to the book. It started with the copy editor of the book, who, instead of copy editing, which means just making sure that your punctuation is okay and your paragraphs are okay, started putting hateful comments in the columns of the book. It was so extreme that the book had to be re-edited. This man just kind of went nuts reading the book. My editor said he'd never encountered anything like it. And then it went on and on from there. But the most disturbing part of this is really that it seems to be very common amongst liberal and progressive men also. I've had really bizarre experiences, and one of the experiences that I describe, again, in the 2002 intro, is that quite by chance I had the opportunity to speak to a man who wrote a review for of Boys Will Be Boys, of the first edition, and submitted it to a very well-known left-wing a magazine that he was actually on the board of editors of, and he, for the first time, had something he wrote just simply rejected. And he, it was very interesting to me to be able to speak to him, to get a kind of insider's view, because the book had been rejected for review by a number of very left-wing magazines and liberal magazines. And basically what he told me was that the editor-in-chief was that his comments were just totally irrational, and he thought that he couldn't emotionally deal with my cultural critique of masculinity, and simply didn't even want the book reviewed. So there's something very, very deep here, and as I point out again in the 2000 intro, this enormous resistance on the part of many, by no means all men, but by many men and some women, is a major problem in terms of moving away from a concept of masculinity that is totally, totally inappropriate to an age where our very human existence is endangered by nuclear weapons, by biological, chemical warfare, etc. I mean, I don't need to go into that in detail at this point. I think we're all pretty nervous about what's going to happen in the next few weeks. So we desperately need to move away from a concept of masculinity that's based on things like real men are tough, real men are concerned with majorly concerned with dominance, with being competitive, with winning, with being ready. Real men are ready to fight at the drop of a hat. And basically, we have to move away from a kind of John Wayne image of masculinity that just doesn't work anymore in the 21st century. It didn't work in the 20th century. It led to an extraordinary bloodbath. I think it's about 170 million people, if I remember correctly, who were killed in wars and other political actions in the 20th century, and it's going to be much worse in the 21st if we don't move away from this. But if even men on the political left, or many of them, are so disturbed by this, then how can you deal with a problem? It's as if, okay, for example, just to use an analogy, heart disease is much more common in men than it is in premenopausal women. Now, that's an interesting and important medical fact. If doctors simply ignored that fact completely and acted as if it just didn't exist, they couldn't do as well at preventing heart disease, at helping men who've had heart attacks and so forth and so forth. You need the information about where is the at-risk group, and then how do you deal with that? And that's what Boys Will Be Boys is about. How do we change the way we socialize boys to decrease violence? How do we change the definition of masculinity so that it is defined in a way that is appropriate to the 21st century.
Well, I'd like to introduce Joseph Schultz, who's here in the studio with me as well. Joseph, you're welcome to join in at any point and ask Miriam Miejean any questions that you'd like. I know that the topic is one considering specifically about how dangerous it is, our traditional idea of masculinity, and our current foreign policy and current policymakers and people who are making decisions right now. How would you say that this, these traditional values, these masculine values, are playing out right now? I mean, I thought it was interesting how just today Bush neglected to want to debate Saddam in a public venue. What did you think about that?
Yes, well, obviously, I mean, Bush just, seems to thrive on the image of the gunslinging cowboy, and he's playing the ultimate tough guy with Saddam Hussein. And not that, you see, Saddam Hussein himself is the ultimate image of the really the totally whacked out macho megalomaniac. I mean, let's get that straight. I mean, this man is, well, is nuts. I mean, he's obviously a psychopathic megalomaniac. And part of the problem with our traditional policy is that we have supported this man, and that's since around 1982. We helped him develop his weaponry, his nuclear, his biochemical, everything, and so did the Europeans. Mm-hmm. Now, there's something there which is extraordinarily short-sighted and lacking in any kind of really long-range empathic thinking. And when I say empathic, I mean an ability to think through what the other person, or to have some sense of where the other person is at. Now, obviously, it was extremely foolhardy and dangerous to equip this person, this megalomaniac, with the kinds of weaponry that we did. We created him. We played a major role in creating him. And one of the points that I try to make is that this lack of thinking ahead, of planning, is really on one level an expression of a kind of macho mentality, which we just want to do what's in our immediate interest. We want to be in the case of the 1980s, a lot of it had to do with dominance and power in the sense of wealth, of helping our own companies, weapons manufacturers, etc., achieve more wealth so that it became okay to deal with anybody, or to play cynical, very, very cynical politics. And it's, to me, one of the real pitfalls of the traditional definition of masculinity is that patriotism has become really almost synonymous with macho, tough guy, ready-to-fight soldier, and weaponry. And even now we see this, that to be in many circles, to be against this war is considered unpatriotic. And I remember years ago interviewing one of the New York Times, Tom Wicker, one of the New York Times columnists, who pointed out to me that during the Vietnam War, he was often attacked for being unpatriotic because he was against the war. But Stuart Alsop, another conservative columnist, was never attacked for being unpatriotic. Now, as I see it, equipping a megalomaniac leader who has already exercised high levels of violence, providing him with weaponry, is unpatriotic. But our definition of unpatriotic doesn't extend to that, because it is so focused on the traditional masculinity that patriotism means fighting, means being a soldier. That's what being patriotic means. It means also accumulating weaponry. So that this whole equivalence of patriotism, machoism, weaponry, becomes a front also for large corporations that manufacture weapons, and that's a lot of what's been going on.
Right. I think that also our current example of that would be our funding of Osama bin Laden as well.
Oh, absolutely.
That's another good example of what
absolutely
you're talking about. And I wondered if you could talk about the fact that most of the men who are taking some of the most macho, traditional masculinity kind of roles with this in our foreign policy have never actually engaged in combat themselves, which I think, you know, is important to think about in terms of what does it really mean to confront another human, kill people, see people's bodies around you, and that kind of reality check.
Yes, it's very, very striking that, as we all know, George Bush served in the Texas National Guard, which his daddy got him into, and he then somehow disappeared for a year. Our vice president, Dick Cheney, was in graduate school during Vietnam, and when his graduate deferments ran out, lo and behold, his wife, Lynn, got pregnant. Rumsfeld served in the Navy, but it was in between wars. He never saw action. And all the other advisors, there's really no one there. Colin Powell, it's interesting, who is the,
what's the reason in the situation, perhaps?
Yes, exactly. He actually saw military action. And this is already something that in the first edition of the book, came up. I interviewed a number of military men, and they made this point to me again and again that the men who have seen what they call, I had never heard this expression before, they call it the hamburger on the field, by which they mean, soldiers' guts, legs, hearts, you know, limbs, heads, lying around in pieces and parts on a battlefield, that those men really take it seriously and don't want war, unless they themselves are, you know, a bit of psychopaths. Maybe someone like Oliver North, you know, has seen it all and still thinks it's a great thing. But a huge majority of those men don't want to go near it, or they only want war at the most, as the most extreme last resort, if there's just nothing else left. But for these guys who are orchestrating this, and the one gal who's there, they've never experienced this. And I must say that our president strikes me, and certainly the vice president, who was men with, I suspect, very, very low levels of empathy, or very low capacity for empathy of any kind. And I think this is a major problem. There also, I must say that I never thought, would have thought years ago that I would have any sympathy for the notion of a, of the draft. But in recent months, I think like many people have really thought about this, because our army is now made up mainly of poor and working class people. And as you probably know, there's, I believe, there's only one member of Congress, the entire Congress, who has a, I believe, a son who's in the military. No one else, none of the other people who are making these decisions have any family member, any child in the military. And
right, it just speaks to how specialized those, that group has become, and that they aren't really connected with the people of the United States.
Exactly, exactly. So I guess I've become more sympathetic to the system that they have in Germany now, where there is a military service that's required of all young, I believe it's young men, but they have the alternative of doing a public service work. And I think if they choose the public service, they have to do a little longer. They, I think the military might be a year, and public service is perhaps, I forget, a year and a half or two, something like that. But they have the option to not do the military service if they really don't want to do it, if that just repels them.
Right. That sounds like a good
You talk repeatedly in your book about the necessity of developing empathy in men and people in general.
Yes.
And I you know, you also mentioned that for someone to be an effective warrior, they have to have empathy. I believe you said, I mean, you can't very well win a victory against an antagonist unless you have some idea of what they're going to be doing, and that means some sort of empathy. Could you talk a little bit about the difference between, you know, I mean, how empathy, well, I don't know, can you expand on this idea of how empathy,
empathy can... Yeah, okay, let me just say, it's not, okay, to be a warrior in the sense of, like, being out there as a soldier where you might have to kill people, or at least that's part of your job, there, empathy is not very useful at all, because that's in fact, that's probably one reason that empathy has been so driven out of boys and men for historically, because they really have been raised to be soldiers or possible future soldiers, because a soldier does not need empathy, or it's much harder to go out there and kill people if you're empathic. Where you need empathy is in any kind of negotiations or dealing with other countries in international relations, and that's where so many people in government, especially, I mean, since government has been mainly men, are lacking in that empathy. There's, you know, the well-known Getting to Yes by Fitcher and Urey, a book on negotiations, which is one of, considered sort of a basic text on negotiations, and one of the points that they make in that book is that if you're unable to put yourself in the mental state of the other side, if you can't figure out how what you do appears to them, then you're not going to be very good at negotiating anything, and you're also going to make some really bad mistakes. I was very struck when I interviewed Robert McNamara, the former Secretary of Defense during the entire Vietnam War, who told me that during the Cold War, that as he saw it, and in terms of documents that have come out, that the Americans misinterpreted much of what the Soviets did, because the men in our government didn't understand how our actions affected them, so that in fact they were scared of us, as just as we were scared of them, but they were scared of us, so that we would do, we would commit some action, and then they would do something which then was defensive in nature, but because we couldn't understand how we appeared to them, they, we misinterpreted, and we would take their action to be an aggressive one. So this ability to look at things from the other one side's perspective is essential, and right now, I must say that it's really beyond my comprehension what these people in power who seem so intent on getting us into a war in Iraq, I just cannot understand the level of their lack of empathy and understanding of what this is going to do in terms of increasing terrorism against the United States. They simply don't seem to have any understanding of how to the rest of the world the United States is this huge
gorilla.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And that the rest of the world, in a sense, lives in fear of us, and that we appear extremely arrogant, I mean, especially since this administration has come in, extraordinarily arrogant, that we've just abrogated, annulled all kinds of treaties since the Bush team came in, that we've disregarded Kyoto agreements. I mean, you know, you could list it on and on. And of course that we are already despised by a large part of the Muslim population. And here again, let's get it straight that you know, Osama bin Laden and the Al-Qaeda boys, I mean, they are just as much part of this, you know, what I call the masculine mystique. If anything, you know, that's one of the major problems, it seems to me, of the in the Muslim world, that it's a world that is extraordinarily macho, in the sense that I mean, women in that world have virtually no rights at all. It's an extremely male-dominated world, and it's also a world which is very, very focused on issues of honor and dominance and all of that kind of stuff. So instead of being sensitive to that and then realizing how these, you know, these guys out there who are so concerned with their power and dominance, how they're going to experience our attacking Iraq, we're talking about, I mean, these people in power are talking about democracy and Iraq becoming a role model for the rest of the Muslim
right.
countries.
They're disconnected from reality there.
I can't even get to square one on right. that.
I just like to tell the listeners that we are speaking with Miriam Yejon. She is an author of the book Boys Will Be Boys, Breaking the Link Between Masculinity and Violence. And this is 96.3 on your FM dial. And did you have something, Joseph?
Well, I wonder if we could pursue this question. When you talk about someone like, say, Stalin, probably one of the more ruthless people that's ever lived, he certainly was able to outmaneuver his opponents by, you know, second-guessing what they would think. On a certain level, you could say he was very empathetic with his opponents,
yes.
because he
mm-hmm.
was all he knew what they were thinking before they did and was able to act on it. And Osama bin Laden, in the same way, was able to, you know, to forecast how events would play into his, you know, his worldview, if you will. Can you draw a distinction between, you know, empathy in the service of ruthlessness, empathy in the service of what we would see as negative?